Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. We're also pleased to have here in the studio Congressman Tim Johnson. He represents the 15th District in Washington, has been in Congress here representing this area now for a while. Before that, was in the Illinois House for quite a long time. And occasionally when we have the opportunity, we'd like to invite him to come here in the studio so that constituents we'll have an opportunity to talk with him. I can certainly ask questions, but the point here is that people who are listening can ask the questions as well. And so if you'd like to talk with us, and we already have a couple of people ready to go, all you have to do is dial us up here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. The only thing we ask of people to call in is just be brief as you can so that we can get in as many callers as we can. Thanks very much.
We're glad to be here, David.
I'll get right to it. We'll not make these people wait. We have one from Champaign, one from Urbana, and Champaign goes first. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I just wanted to thank the congressman for his recent vote in support of the WILL stations, $100 million, I believe. And I believe there's another $100 million hanging around waiting to be voted on later, and I hope that he will support that as well. I know that was not an easy vote for him, and I think it does indicate that he is responsive to his constituents, and we really appreciate that.
Well, thank you for your call, and you're right. There was a good deal of pressure from various sources to vote the other way, but not only from the standpoint of representing superior broadcasting like we have here locally, but also from the standpoint of providing a unique service, so to speak. My vote was one that I cast enthusiastically, and if the additional money comes to the fore, you can certainly count on my support in favor of public broadcasting.
Thanks very much, and I'm happy to hear that.
Thanks for your call.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Representative Johnson, and last week's polls showed nearly 30% of Republicans willing to impeach George Bush if proven that he misled the American people on evidence leading up to the invasion of Iraq. Where do you stand? And thanks for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I obviously am not going to endorse impeachment of the president. We want to determine, like everyone else does, whether the information that we're afforded and upon which we act is good information. I have no particular reason to suspect that anyone deliberately misled us. Certainly, as we look back, there are issues and aspects of our involvement in Iraq that caused me a great deal of question. And I appreciate the caller. I certainly am not one at this point who's going to call for the impeachment of the president. I do have a concern about bettering the, let's say, transmission of information from point A to point B, whether it be George Bush or Bill Clinton or Richard Nixon. So it's certainly something that causes me concern, but I don't have any reason to believe at this point that George Bush has committed any impeachable offense.
Let me ask you a couple of things about Iraq. In a speech last week, the president said essentially some of the things that he has said in the past. And one of the things that he's been very firm about is that he believes it's important that we're there and that we can't set any kind of a date for withdrawal for obvious reasons. However, at the same time, I think that a lot of people, whether you support the war or not, want to know that one of the questions they have in their mind is, how much longer are we going to be there?
I think the president did certainly an adequate job of explaining his position, but I tend to agree with you, and I think a lot of my constituents, and that is that while we may be overplaying our hand by specifying a date, we do need, I believe, just simply for purposes of morale at home as well as overseas. I have a chief of staff right now in the middle of the Sunni Triangle and has been for some time, leaving a wife and a baby at home. There is a human side to this issue, and I think there's got to be an exit strategy of some form or another articulated and on the horizon, because if we don't have that, I think people face the reality of simply living with one more day of another 10 bodies, human lives involved. And it's easy to be very generic about it, but we're not generic. These are human beings in Iraq and at home. And I'm not condemning the policy of the administration. I'm not trying to micromanage policy. But I am suggesting that while the president may be right about a date certain, that we do need to have a strategy by which American troops can withdraw and have a constitution in place, have Iraq, and they seem to be well on their way to establishing as best we can a democracy and some stability in an area that's a breeding ground for instability around the world. Keeping in mind that in some ways, the causative chain is not as discernible as we'd like, there is a relationship between peace and freedom and stability, freedom from terror at home and around the world, and our willingness to strike at the core of it. And so I think there's always two sides to every coin, and I think we've got to balance any approach with that in mind.
Well, do you feel that you have heard from the White House an adequate kind of exit strategy? Would you like to hear more than you've heard so far?
Yeah, I haven't heard very much so far. And I'd certainly like to hear more.
What about, I think that one of the things that sometimes confuses people, or at least causes controversy, is that over time, the administration has given different reasons for our being there, and that a lot of people are not really sure. For you, if I ask the question, well, why are we there? What's your answer?
I would have a difficult time answering that as well as I should be able to, David, to be perfectly frank with you. I'm not going to mislead. In terms of my, if you ask me, if I were in charge of the Department of Defense and had access to their information, maybe perhaps my answer would be different. At this point, it is clear that the spread of democracy and the lessening of a breeding ground for terror has been facilitated by our presence there. Now, whether that's sufficient to justify continued involvement to the extent that we are involved is another question. And I, like the caller, and like you, and like I think a majority of the people in my district, want to see an exit strategy. I want to see a clear delineation of why we continue to be there, and I want to be able to have those parameters met and have Americans, at least at some reasonable time in the future, on their way home. And I think most people would agree, though, it would be very difficult and probably counterproductive to just simply cut and run in tomorrow's wake.
Yeah. Well, one more question, then I'll get on to callers. Again, the administration has said that they think that it's important for us to be there, that there is good news, and that the trend is positive. And about a month or so ago, in fact, the vice president, Mr. Cheney, said that he thought the insurgency was in its last throes. And it wasn't long after that that we had representatives of the Pentagon, General Abzaid and Secretary of Defense, saying something rather different. Yeah. Mr. Rumsfeld said that, he was not being specific about Iraq, but he said, well, you know, insurgencies can go on a long time. And I think he said something like, you know, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 years. So he was making it sound as if it would not be unexpected if this insurgency could go on 7, 8, 10 years. What do you think when you hear something like that?
I don't think that sort of timetable is acceptable to the American people. The American people are represented in the Congress by members of the House and Senate. I'm one of them, and involvement for a decade is not something that I look favorably on.
Let's talk with some other folks here. We'll go to a caller in Mattoon, line 3.
Good morning, Congressman. I have two separate questions.
You're going to see me down at the Bagel Fest this year?
I hope so. I hope so. As that the Mattoon is looking forward to supporting it. We've had the Bagel Fest here for many years, and I think they've got the record for having the largest bagel baked in the U.S. down here.
So. I'll let you do your question, but in a more immediate sense, I was down there just last weekend, and was walking, did my little walk around the YMCA and went by the Amtrak facilities. And that depot needs a lot of work. We got a transportation bill that's pending, and we're hopeful that we can get some money for your depot.
Well, thank you. We certainly appreciate it. And that actually relates to part of my question, is the fact that we spend millions of dollars on airports, and we spend millions of dollars on highways, but the administration and some members of Congress have voted and do not support Amtrak. Can you maybe explain the congressional thoughts that are negative against Amtrak? And my second area of question is reference to medical accounts that federal employees have the medical service accounts while they were employed, but when their salaries at retirement were reduced, they no longer have those medical service accounts. Can you explain why that has not...
Yeah, no, on the latter question, I can't. I'm sure that my sentiment would be 100% in coincident with yours. It would seem to me to be entirely reasonable that that would be something we could do. But I'm not familiar enough, frankly, with the issue to be able to give you a very intelligent answer, other than to say that, that the sentiment you appear to be expressing is one that I agree with. I'm not going to tell you why people would advocate for cuts in Amtrak, because I'm not in favor of cuts for Amtrak. I am in favor of, with a finite budget, making sure that those unprofitable routes, Florida and the West and other places, aren't subsidized by routes that are profitable, namely Champaign, Mattoon, Pontiac, and Bloomington. And I want to make sure Amtrak stays on the tracks and that we continue to support it with public dollars, but also that we continue to make sure that we realize that some lines are profitable and others aren't, and those that aren't need to not expect us to subsidize those that that are not.
So. You don't feel that we don't spend more money on our highways and roads and airports? And if the train system was put back into good shape and the roads, that we could have something similar to what Europe is?
No, I'm a strong advocate for mass transportation and Amtrak specifically, and I've consistently voted that way. I am in total agreement with you.
Okay, well, thank you very kindly.
Right, thanks. This is something I actually did want to ask you about, because I saw it the other day that you voted against.
No, I was misleading.
Yeah, because that was not clear to me what.
Yeah, I wish that service that puts those voting rolls in the paper would be more clear. I have consistently voted in Congress on every single vote in support of Amtrak, including that. That was an amendment to the underlying to an underlying bill by Corrine Brown from Florida. And essentially what that amendment would have done, it would have been done tremendous damage to our Amtrak services. Phil Bloomberg's right here with Nate now. We're going to do an op-ed on that. Would have done tremendous damage to our local routes, because essentially it said those routes like Florida and others that aren't profitable, that lose money, that we ought to subsidize them with routes like Champaign to Chicago and Mattoon to Chicago that are profitable. And so I was a little chagrined that they weren't more specific in terms of how they voted. We actually voted on a voice vote to restore the cuts in Amtrak, and obviously I supported that and have consistently supported Amtrak funding along the way. I wish they were, you know, they're doing a good service by pointing out votes. They're doing a bad service by when they point out the total reverse of what the vote actually was. But, you know, I guess, you know, the rest of the reportage was fairly accurate.
Yeah. So basically, you support the idea of some government support as long as the service itself is making money.
Well, I support government. I even go so far as to say that I support Amtrak funding even if the overall service is not making money, because I don't think there's any way that Amtrak in the foreseeable future is ever going to be a profit-making venture. So I'm not saying that profitability is a precondition to my support for Amtrak. I support it anyway. All I'm saying is within the budget framework, we have a certain number of dollars dedicated, and if we have to prioritize within Amtrak itself between the Champaign-Chicago run and the Palm Beach-Miami run, I'm opting for our services here that within the structure of things have done what they can to be effective.
Okay. Our guest this morning here on Focus 580 is Congressman Tim Johnson. If you have questions, you can give us a call. We'll try to get as many as we can. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to line number one, someone in Urbana. Hello.
Well, I am a Democrat, but I also feel that you indeed are doing a fairly decent job for the people of Illinois, and I don't quite understand all of the tit for tat, the, you know, I'll support you on this if you'll support me on this. And I do feel that because this part of our country, this part of Illinois, did not vote as heavily for Bush as you would like, that our services are being cut, our funding, federal funding. I understand that you do need to prioritize how your votes go. I'd also like to know, though, what real progress we're making on peace after Iraq. I know that's a little presumptuous, but if we continue the way we're going now, we're going to have huge problems. What is the State Department, what is the Finance Department doing to make peace possible?
No, that's a good point. I mean, if we're there to bring a semblance of democracy and bring some degree of stability to the region, and we have no strategy for what happens after we leave, then we've really spent dollars and lost lives for virtually nothing. Your point is extremely well taken.
And even this bit, excuse me, about the new justices or justice for the Supreme Court, it says we gear up for a fight. We're not fighting in the United States quite yet, but it should be, how are we cooperating? How is Bush working with the American people? He said he would when we elected him.
Let me respond, not respond, but kind of join your in the chorus here in two regards. First of all, with respect to the concern about trade-offs and so forth, I share your concern. I don't like to see the deal making that goes on any more than you do. I will say, however, that in terms of this specific area, I'm trying to be as humble as I can be here, we've been very effective about bringing federal dollars to not only to this university for research, but transportation dollars and otherwise. So I don't believe we're being singled out in this area. In fact, we've gotten more than our share for the area. In fact, we have a $35 million currently in the transportation $35 million in the transportation budget for a variety of infrastructure needs here in Central Illinois. You're absolutely right when you look at the blogs, so to speak, and see the continual chorus is fight, let's battle this, let's do this. And the same thing's true in Congress. I am the co-chair of the Center Aisle Caucus. The Center Aisle Caucus is co-chaired by Representative Steve Israel, a liberal Democrat from New York. And he and I, now we have, I think, 25 or 30 members. And our whole premise, more than that, actually, 30 or 40 members, our co-chairs are former Minority Leader Bob Michael and former Speaker Tom Foley from Washington, Republican and Democrat. And the whole premise is, let's put aside the battles, the fighting, the internet, not the internecine, but the warfare that goes on there, and let's work together constructively for solutions to issues. And where we can agree, and there are certainly issues that Steve Israel and I may not agree on, let's at least disagree agreeably. The caller is absolutely right. How much discouragement can that provide for the American people, for the people of the 15th District, when they see 435 members of Congress acting like kindergartners? It's just something that is simply not acceptable. And all I can do is just be a personal example of not conducting myself that way. Your call is 100% right.
Well, can we get some news from Washington about how we are working together, how we are trying to make the United States whole again? It seems to me this is a July 4th weekend, and we are fighting not only Iraq, we're fighting the Revolutionary War, and we're fighting the Civil War all over again. And our democracy does not seem to be working well enough for us to be paying billions of dollars to export it.
I can't disagree with what you're saying. Phil Bloomer's sitting here next to me. He's our communications director, and part of his job is to make sure that you all know what at least some of us are doing in Washington, D.C. to try to bring some civility to the process.
Well, I've tried to talk to the News Gazette a couple times to tell them, show us some news that tells how we got to where we are so we can start to heal. And he doesn't listen. They don't listen. Who does Bush listen to?
Well, I can't speak for Bush. I can speak for myself, and part of my answer is that I listen to you. I'll tell you an area that we're trying to achieve and have achieved a good deal of, if not unanimity, at least some consensus, is the recent decision on the Supreme Court, the Milo versus City of New London case, that has to do with eminent domain. I think that's a good example of how we can work together as people of diversity on the political spectrum to try to bring some civility to dialogue and also to address issues. So I can't disagree with anything you said, ma'am.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let us continue, and we'll go next to Urbana, and this is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I was hoping I could get the congressman to speak a little bit more about the Amtrak situation. I did want to thank you for your ongoing support for Amtrak and passenger rail service in the U.S. You were talking about profitable routes versus unprofitable routes, and am I misunderstanding that the city of New Orleans route would be considered one of the unprofitable routes?
I don't believe that it would consider it to be unprofitable. I want to be clear about this. I'm not suggesting that my support for Amtrak, and it is strong and consistent, is conditional upon its profitability. I support it because I believe it's a necessary service, and sometimes we have to pay a subsidy for necessary services. And I don't believe in the foreseeable future that the Amtrak system is going to be able to be profitable, quote unquote. But I do believe that within the Amtrak system, some routes are more, maybe profitable is the inartful word, are more economically successful than others. And the City of New Orleans route, as I understand it, the one that goes through Champaign and Rantoul and Mattoon, Charleston, and otherwise, is one of the better routes in terms of its effectiveness, not only for services, but also in terms of the dollars that, that go into it and come out of it.
Okay. I would be very concerned to see that line shut down because then
we'd
have one train a day from Champaign.
Absolutely not. No, I am strongly supportive of Amtrak generally, and obviously even more strongly supportive of that particular line.
Okay. I had seen something recently where it was proposed that all routes that lost $30 per passenger or more would be eliminated, and that would be basically all of the long-distance trains from what I understand, and I think that a lot of those long-distance trains serve people going much shorter distances. I mean, I've never taken the train all the way down to New Orleans, but I've definitely taken it to Chicago a number of times.
Arlo Guthrie took it, didn't he? City of New Orleans? It's a good route.
Yeah.
I didn't want to hear me sing, so keep that out the air. But I have to be provincial to some extent, and I'm realistic, and I know that there are, if we're successful in fighting the cuts, there's still only going to be a finite amount of dollars to go into Amtrak, X amount, whatever that might be. I want to maximize it, but it's still X amount. And within the structure of dollars that are there, I want to make sure that all the dollars that we can, we obtain and secure for our local routes, the Champaign, Mattoon, Rantoul line, as well as the line that goes essentially in my district from Bloomington Normal up through Pontiac and in that direction. So I'm going to advocate for the system generally, but I'm going to specifically advocate for the lines that serve our district.
And what do you see as a long-term solution to the funding problem for Amtrak? Because every year they have to go back kind of begging for money, never knowing if they're how much they're going to get. We don't have any sort of long-term funding solution for Amtrak like we do for our highway system or for the air traffic control system, for example. What do you see as a solution to that?
Well, I'm not sure there is one silver bullet. Phil has pointed out to me a point with respect to fuel prices and the necessity of passing an energy bill, but obviously that's not going to strike entirely at the underlying. I think the reality is that we have to regard Amtrak. I think we have to establish a mindset that Amtrak rail passenger service is a public service, that we want to do everything we can to maximize its effectiveness in terms of dollars, to make it efficient, but that it's not going to make money. It's not a profit-making venture. It's not General Motors or Chrysler. And we have to understand that there's going to be a subsidy and a price to be paid for the benefits. And obviously the benefits are environmental, they're safety, they're convenience, and they're otherwise. And so I'm not sure in terms of the overall solution, other than the solution has got to be that we're going to have to pay dollars to get what we want to get in terms of public service, and Amtrak's one of them. And I think we ought to just dismiss this notion that we're only going to support the service if it makes a dollar, because as much as I want it to, that's not going to happen.
I agree completely with you. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. We're about at a midpoint here, talking with Congressman Tim Johnson. We will continue, but first we must take 1 minute to do this. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This
and this is Focus 580 here on AM 580. I'm David Inge.
Thank God we don't have any emergencies.
Yes, we have no emergencies to tell you about this morning. If you want to talk with our guest, Congressman Tim Johnson, represents the 15th Congressional District. A lot of folks here in our listening area in the 15th, and every once in a while when he's here in the district, we ask him to come and take questions, and that's what we're doing. Whatever's on your mind, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a caller in Homer, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. This is Paul Anderson.
Oh, hi, Paul. How are you?
Good. I was calling with regard to the Central American Free Trade Agreement. I guess I'd like to do a little refresher. Since inception of NAFTA, the United States has lost 879,280 American jobs, of which 1,600 Maytag workers here in Illinois lost their jobs when Maytag took manufacturing to Mexico. I understand just this past week that the Senate passed the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and soon the Congress will be asked to vote on this.
The House, you mean?
The House, excuse me. The six countries that make up the CAFTA agreement have roughly the population of California and New Jersey, and collectively have an economic output roughly equivalent to New Haven, Connecticut. I don't think CAFTA is going to be about free trade as much as we need trade for agricultural goods and so on. I believe CAFTA is more about outsourcing more jobs, and this nation can't handle that. We've lost too many already.
Do you want me to comment? I'm just listening to you, and I'm happy to happy to listen. I'm still in the process of internalizing all the information, so I guess the best I can tell you, I wasn't here in the Congress when NAFTA was approved.
Yes, I know that.
I am open-minded about CAFTA. That I do think we have to look at each trade agreement in and of itself, and not and one of the unfortunate things about this is you use these little acronyms, and everybody just assumes this is NAFTA too. And the reality is that CAFTA is something entirely different than NAFTA. In fact, many people in Central America, in the Dominican Republic, feel this is too one-sided, and that the only effect of it will be to benefit our ag producers and otherwise, and that the only thing we're giving up is a few tariffs with respect to sugar. Now, I want to look at the agreement in full and make sure that that is, in fact, a correct assessment of what CAFTA is. But I do think sometimes we tend to overgeneralize in these areas and just assume every free trade agreement is the same, and some are, and some aren't. You know, NAFTA is one thing, and Morocco is something else, and I think we have to look at them each in and of themselves under the President's Trade Promotion Authority and our obligation to support or not support it.
Okay, well, I guess, you know, given their collective, these six nations, their collective economic output equal to New Haven, Connecticut, how much of our goods and services are they going to be actually able to buy? I mean,
as I understand it, I was on the plane the other day with Rob Portman, former congressman from Cincinnati, who's our new trade negotiator. The impact to Illinois, for example, 15th District, corn growers, soybean producers, livestock producers, would be substantial. Now, I want to ascertain for myself. While I trust Mr. Portman, I want to ascertain for myself what the real effect is, and if it is in fact what you say, and if many of the problems that result from it are those that you describe, then I obviously want to know that. But I, at this point, I'm undecided. But your information, your input, as well as everybody else's, is important to me here.
Okay, I appreciate that. You know, NAFTA is a 900-page agreement. I realize, yeah, you said that they're not the same thing, and that's accurate. NAFTA is a 900-page document. Why do we need 900 pages of verbiage to sell corn and beans to anybody?
Well, I didn't negotiate the treaty, so I haven't read it all yet.
I know, but this is another step in that same direction. And of course, this is a precursor to the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which would encompass all of South America, the entire Western Hemisphere, with exception of Cuba.
And it's a point well made. I'm I'm hopeful that you'll think that my considerations of this are deliberative, and you've helped me right in your call right here.
Okay.
But if you expect me to tell you on the phone that I'm going to vote against CAFTA, that's not going to happen. I mean, I want to hear all the input both ways, and at this point we're a ways away from voting on it, and I'm undecided. I must tell you that at this point that I'm leaning in support of CAFTA and approving it because I believe that it's the benefit to American economy generally and specifically to the 15th District and our ag producers is substantial. But I can be persuaded to the contrary.
Okay. Well,
I don't want to mislead you. I don't want to leave you with a conversation and have me just be a typical politician and say, yeah, and then do whatever I want. I want to hear you, but at this point, if I had to vote today, I'd vote in favor of it.
Okay. Well, I guess I would encourage you to, you know, just see.
I will.
How much economic possibilities there are with these countries to actually trade with us.
Well, Paul, I've respected your expertise and your input for a long time, and there's no difference here, so I'll continue to listen, buddy.
Thank you much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just for a moment here, and we'll get back to callers, I do want to have you talk a little bit about energy legislation. Now, the House and the Senate have each passed bills, and now it goes to the point where the differences between the two have to get worked out in conference. And there are significant differences. Can you just talk a little bit about what exactly are the most important differences, as far as you're concerned, in the two bills, and how do you see this being worked out?
One of the differences is some of the add-ons in one chamber or the other that are meant to benefit specific areas. And specifically, this isn't sufficient to have me vote against the bill, but I don't like to see the provisions with respect to immunization for MTBE producers that were contained in the bill. That's, frankly, one of the holdups. The Texas delegation believes, for example, that they ought to be included. I don't. There are some differences with respect to the electrical grid systems, and then some underlying philosophical differences that really are pretty broad-based. I think those are going to be resolved. The underlying issue for me, being, again, fairly provincial, is the renewable fuels portion of it, some of the energy conservation measures contained in it, the wind power provisions, which are extremely important but underpublicized, and I believe the general need to do even more in this energy bill to encourage energy conservation. But we are at a conference committee stage. This is going to be an imperfect bill, and I'm sure whatever the vote is, that I'm going to leave plenty of people, plenty to criticize me for. But I am 100% committed to vote in favor of an energy bill, get an energy policy adopted in the United States, and have as many provisions contained within it that I support that I can. But one way or the other, I'm not going to allow one or two or three issues to hold up approval of an extremely important bill.
So when do you think there'll be something for the president to sign?
I think it'll be by the August break. We have 3 weeks starting next week before the August break, and I'm confident that both an energy and a transportation conference committee report will be passed during that time and that the president will be able to act on them.
All right. Next caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Congressman Johnson, you know better than anyone, I guess, that there are a whole lot of folks in the 15th District who are really worried about President Bush's proposal for private accounts in Social Security and benefit cutbacks, and they're concerned about what's happening to our commitment to Social Security for the elderly and for people with disabilities and for their families. I wondered whether I think I've gotten kind of mixed messages on your position on this. WILL reported a little while back from your office that you felt that private accounts should not be part of a solution to Social Security. And I if that's true, I think that's a great position because, in fact, private accounts, whatever challenges there are for Social Security, private accounts will make the finances work.
Worse.
Yeah.
Let me just clarify that before, because I'm afraid if we get too long, far along, then I'll forget the original question.
Sorry.
I think that's a correct assessment in that I believe the president has done at best a mediocre job and probably a C-minus job of explaining, and frankly some of the opposition has done a C-minus job of responding to the reality, and the reality is that the underlying sanctity of Social Security, the underlying viability of Social Security, is almost totally non-related to personal accounts. Personal accounts are a different philosophical issue, and I suppose we're going to have to get a chance to address that issue. But to even suggest that personal accounts are going to address the long-run demographic problem of Social Security is not accurate. They don't. They have nothing to do with it, or virtually nothing to do with it. I'm not suggesting that I think I remain open-minded on this issue, both on the long-term viability solutions as well as personal accounts. But I do think they need to be considered in separate veins because they aren't related to one another.
So,
I don't believe they aggravate the problem because I think in the long run, if you pay less in today, you take less out in the long haul. So, in a strictly economic sense, I believe they're essentially a wash. But there's certainly ones that don't enhance the system.
Yeah, and I mean, my concern would be that it's much worse than a wash. Because, in fact, even the proposals of the Bush administration involve not only cutting back the fund you're going to have, but also real cuts in benefits, right? I mean,
one of the problems is I haven't seen many specific proposals so far.
Right, I know, but there
from anybody.
Yeah, well, what I was wondering is you talk on a number of these issues about waiting for inputs on both sides. But is it enough to say that at this stage, that in something that you'd consider over the next 6 months, that private accounts are not part of a solution and that you would not want to cut Social Security benefits? I mean, is that...
Do I want to cut Social Security benefits? No. And I'm not going to support anything that eliminates the underlying... commitment that we've made to seniors and others in our Social Security system. But the reality is that there are a lot more people of my age that are living a lot longer. There are a lot less people, like my children and grandchildren, that are born and pay into the system to support what was once a 20-to-1 ratio is now a 3-to-1, soon be a 2.5-to-1 ratio. I'm not in favor of cuts to address the issue, but we do have to recognize that in some form or fashion, whether it's increased taxes, whether it's a calculation of benefits, whether it's an increase in retirement age or all the above, that it's not a problem that's going to go away by just closing our eyes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's not a problem that's going to go away by private accounts.
The only relationship in a public domain of public private accounts to the problem of Social Security is not one of actuality, but of quote-unquote pain. If you level out benefits, and I'm not advocating for that, but if you calculate them, for example, as some have proposed on the basis of prices rather than wages, then at some point in the future when those benefits for future retirees, I don't want to say level out, but don't increase to the extent that they are now, and some people have argued that private accounts allow those same people to make more money on their investment, which, I'm sure you have some question about and we all want to look at.
Right.
Then I suppose from the standpoint of somebody's mental health, so to speak, when they're receiving a leveled out benefit but have more coming into their pocket through private accounts, the pain is not as apparent. But certainly on the issue itself, they're not related to one another.
Yeah.
And I think that the opponents and proponents have been... chasing a phantom when they're presuming that they're related. I'm not sure that private accounts in and of themselves are a bad idea. I want to look at those, see what the bills are. I haven't seen any bills or hardly any bills, but they're certainly not related to the underlying sanctity of Social Security.
But it does sound like, I know there's a big rally planned for July 26th urging you to oppose private accounts. But it does sound like there's still reason for people to mobilize, to get in touch with you.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. No, I want people to do that.
I
tell you one thing, we take a lot of pride in this office on making sure that we maintain the area of communication. I want to hear from people.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. I guess one of the things on this that I thought that I had read was that there were a substantial number of Republicans in the House who were interested in seeing some version of private accounts go forward. Now, Now, the president has invested a lot of time in promoting the idea. There doesn't seem to be a lot of public support for it. Among, as far as you know, among your fellow Republicans in Congress, would there be enough interest so that you could move something that would be some version of the private account?
It's hard to determine, David. If the proposals were coupled in with various other proposals with respect to pensions and otherwise, and sometimes you get these bills that not only encourage personal accounts but 16 other concepts, some of which support, and you're always in the dilemma of, you know, how do you vote against some things you're for, and or when you have a bill with a lot of riders on it. So I've looked and I haven't seen very much specific. There's been a few proposals that have been brought forth, but I think we're a long ways away from a solution.
Well, given how complicated it is, given how difficult it is to put something like this together, would you even expect anything significant to happen on this year?
I don't believe so, although Roy Blunt was quoted the other day, the majority whip, is saying that he's going to try to do something between the July 4th break and August. I find that very hard to believe. And talking to my colleagues, this is the third rail.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to another caller here. Matt Toon, I believe, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
How are you, sir?
I have comments and a question on a couple of items. On the Social Security, I was very concerned that there are congressmen from the South and from Missouri that look upon Social Security as a dinosaur to be taken care of.
Well, I certainly don't agree with that.
Well, I certainly don't either. And having lost a son-in-law in his 40s from heart attack and with a small child and a wife, the benefits from the insurance part of it, I look at Social Security as also an insurance program, and it'd be rough if they lost some of those benefits. And I wonder if you might comment. I have another question besides this one, but my comment on raising contributions for people make over $90,000 a year. I don't think that's a part of the contribution now. And another question.
Well, I assume that if you're advocating for that, I presume you would be in favor of also calculating people's benefit on those higher levels of contribution, right?
Yeah, that goes along with it. That's true.
Yeah.
And those are details that should be worked out. But I understand that if that was raised to $90,000, that'd go a long way in helping the program.
As far as
private accounts are concerned, we got IRAs, we got 401ks. We don't need private accounts.
Well, those are three or four points. While I don't necessarily oppose increasing the contribution income limit, I also want to point out to you that contrary to what I had thought, and apparently what you think, that it is a tiny drop in the bucket in terms of solution of the underlying viability of Social Security. That buys us an extra 2 or 3 years, and that's all. So the increasing the limit from 90 to 200,000, very appealing. There's certainly a lot to be said for it, but it doesn't even come close to addressing the viability issue. I thought it did too, but I've seen the statistics. I've seen the calculations economically, and it is. I don't want to say a drop in the bucket, but it is not a major solver of the problem.
Well, it is. Also, I hear that it's going to be many, many years before the program goes bankrupt, and there is some controversy there. But a question that I would like to bring up too on another subject is this stem cell.
Is what?
I have acquaintances I think if the program should go on and they might help people with Alzheimer's and palsy and a number of other things, I just want to comment on your opposition to stem cells.
I haven't opposed stem cells.
Pardon?
I have not opposed. I don't know where you get that information.
Well,
I've not supported federal funding of certain aspects of stem cell research, because I think we're acting in areas, we're talking about federal dollars, but I've certainly not, I've not advocated eliminating stem cell research.
You want it to be financed privately then?
Not entirely. I certainly believe that there are certain aspects of federal funding that make sense, but I also think we've got to be very careful, just like with CAFTA and NAFTA, making sure that what we're investing your taxpayers' dollars on are proven, or at least partially proven, areas. I'm not in opposition to stem cell research. I had a father die of diabetes, a grandfather die of Parkinson's. I'm very sympathetic to addressing the issue. But I think using catchwords and assuming that that's going to solve all the problems when we're dealing with federal dollars that can be used perhaps more effectively in other areas is somewhat counterintuitive.
Well, it appears like experiments and research abroad is getting ahead of us, where we're not really doing much except on state levels. And, of course, there are states that are pushing this.
Well, adult stem cell research has been extremely effective. And I think that's a good area where we can channel federal dollars. Embryonic stem cell research is another issue.
Well, I'm glad to hear that your feelings on it. I couldn't understand why you would be opposed to it. No. It didn't seem to make sense.
Well, you know, it's people like to put everything in black and white categories, and they aren't.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I hope to continue to your feelings on Social Security and not ruin it as an insurance program.
My feeling on Social Security is I'm about 3 years away from it myself, and for myself and my children and grandchildren, and as people who are on it now, I want to make sure that it remains part of our social services.
All right, thank you for the call. Let's go on to Champaign for the next line one. Hello.
Hi. I hear a lot of talk about raising taxes. Why don't you look for other sources to tax, like the Internet?
You mean for Social Security?
Well,
or just generally?
Just in general, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to conduct a fishing expedition to figure out every way we could possibly raise money, but I'm not one who's advocated tax increases, that's for sure. I hadn't thought much about the Internet one way or the other. What do you propose we do, tax Internet services?
Well, sure. At federal and at state level, because a lot of states are growing broke, and I know you don't have much involvement with that, but if the federal government is looking for other sources of income to bring down the deficit or whatever, that there's another source right there.
Yeah,
and
I appreciate your call, and I'm not gonna advocate creating a new tax on the Internet. I think that the system's working pretty well right now, in that regard, I'd hate to introduce that into the equation.
Thanks for your time.
All right, let's go to line number two, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the upcoming Supreme Court nomination. I recognize it's in the hands of the Senate, but since you are a member of this wonderful, what is it called, Center Aisle Group?
Center Aisle Caucus.
Yes. I thought your voice of reason might be helpful in the upcoming conversation, which threatens to be real.
Just incredible. It has a potential to be a World War III, and I really think you're right. I hope that voices of reason and balance come to the fore in this debate. It has the potential to be one of the most, I don't want to say traumatic, but one of the most agonizing debates in American history, and that serves no one well.
I would agree, and you know, from what over the years I've heard President Bush talk about, he has talked about, for example, Roe v. Wade as a litmus test and looking at specific issues as factors that will help him sway his mind, and that's really very discouraging. Sandra O'Connor, having been billed as a centrist, it's an interesting way to characterize her, because, of course, on the bench, when you have to make a vote, you don't vote in the center. You either vote for or against something. But I guess her centrist reputation comes from the fact that she sometimes voted with the progressives and sometimes with the conservative. And it would really be interesting to try and find somebody like that who's basically independent and who takes on each issue on the merits of itself rather than in a polemical agenda, as many of Bush's potential nominees seem to have.
Well, if I were president, I would have no litmus test.
Yeah.
You got to understand that, and you do, that members of the judiciary have to consider each case that comes before them, not in a litmus test arena, mm-hmm, but in terms mm-hmm. of some kind of a responsible approach to the law.
Yeah,
and they're not trying to be popular; they're trying to do what what the law would dictate.
That's right. So, you know, if Bush winds up nominating or talking about nominating somebody who's really on the extreme right, who's just going to be an ideologue, although you're not in the Senate and won't have the privilege of voting for this, it would be interesting, I think,
privilege of the curse.
Yeah, from your centrist caucus position, perhaps to add some reason
I appreciate your. I think Steve and I are going to discuss that, and we have a meeting the next couple of weeks.
Great.
Although sometimes people in the Senate and other people resent the interference where we get involved in issues that we don't have to vote on. So it's kind of a dilemma either way.
Well, that's their problem.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, I think at that point we're going to have to finish up with thanks to the callers and also thanks to our guest, Tim Johnson. He's representative in Congress from the 15th District, a lot of our listeners in the district. And when we have the opportunity, we'd like to have him here to take questions. Thank you very much.
David, I appreciate it. I hope you and Celeste have a nice trip to the Northeast this year.
Thank you.